Welcome back to the Iowa Crossroad Podcast. Today I'm joined by a guest who wears many different hats. He's a pastor, Iowa State Representative, served as the Assistant Majority Leader for the Iowa House, and also serves as the family leader in their election and policy space. He was one of the sponsors of one of the two life at conception bills that we had this past year. And so, John, sincerely, thank you for taking time to join me today in this conversation.
Absolutely. Actually, I work in the outreach and engagement for Family Leader.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. All right. Outreach and engagement. That's got to be an interesting job. Family Leader is a great organization.
Well, thank you. We like working there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, John, I've got a question for you. So, on February 5th at the Iowa Prayer for Life rally, you presented House File 2332 as an effort to ban the elective abortions in the state. But just 11 days later, you canceled the subcommittee hearing. Why did you make the decision to halt that bill from moving forward?
Yeah, it's just really part of being part of leadership. So what happened as we put the bill forward and the subcommittee was organized, and as I was meeting with representatives, it became pretty clear we didn't have the votes to be able to get it across the finish line. Lots of questions are being raised. There was resistance. And so you make those tough decisions. If I were in the House next year, I'd file that bill again, because I really believe, just like William Wilberforce, you keep asking for that bill to come forward and believing you're going to persist in that. But one of the reasons that I personally fell on the sword is because what was happening was we were becoming pretty clear there was going to be a lot of noise in the community on a bill that was not going to move forward. And in my opinion, it would have put in jeopardy the bill that we knew we could get across the line, the bill we knew that was accounting for about 60% of all abortions, the bill we knew that was going to have some put some weight for some constitutional issues against shield laws, et cetera. And that was the black market abortion pill bill. Mm-hmm. And so my perspective, and through talking with legislators, talking with leadership, that there'd be so much noise created the House stands pretty strong, but it's a little more difficult over in the Senate. But there would be so much noise created that they would not be willing to take up even the black market abortion pill. So it was a strategic decision to go ahead and get done what we knew we could get done, and come back again next year, hopefully with another life at conception bill that we want to advocate for up at the Capitol.
Yeah, well, that'd be great to have that for next year as well. So walk me through this then, because we've got the supermajority in the Iowa House. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's 67-33. Correct. And then we have one away from the supermajority in the Senate, because we lost that one special election. So I believe, if my math's correct, I think we could have lost 16 House votes and 7 Senate votes without having some sort of a tiebreaker vote.
So we're someplace in the 40s in the House, high 40s. So we're not far away in the House. But the reality is, even in a Republican legislature, we have some that do not share the intensity of view that I share about life at conception. And the same issue would be over there in the Senate as well. Until we get to where we know we have 51 votes to move forward, you're just kind of saving some ammunition to fight again. I mean, let's remind ourselves, William Wilberforce did not get abolition of slavery done the first time he offered it. The first thing he did was kill the trade. And then he abolished it, ended up being 1833, abolishing slavery. It's the same kind of strategy here. And it really is about getting ourselves in a position. You know, one of the things that frustrates me, and you know I wear multiple hats, I would say the Iowa House and the Iowa Senate, and hear me clearly, I say this all the time around here. I've sold it to the Pro-Life Coalition. I said, you guys have work to do outside of the legislature, because the legislature in many ways has been more prophetic than the church in Iowa has been. And there is not that strong uprising that we need to have if we're going to move something like this forward. We need to see a strong movement in the churches, a strong movement in the community. Not that we're going to wait for them always to lead, but I actually believe the legislature has been the most prophetic on this issue as a whole, above and beyond other institutions that we see in Iowa.
I think you're right on that. I've talked to my wife several times about it, saying that I think Christians, they're not as involved in the process. And I think part of the reason is sometimes they think that it would ruin their gospel testimony, but we really need to have strong Christians in leadership to be able to make those tough calls and to pass those bills and such.
So, absolutely. I was intricately involved behind the scenes. Really, if you look at the second time we had to do the heartbeat bill just a couple years ago, that was the majority leader who sat down and he and I counted votes and worked it through and made phone calls. I mean, there's so much that happens behind the scenes that doesn't happen on the floor. And you got to remember, you're saving ammunition. You're looking for that moment and that time in which you know you can bring it across the line and you're going to lay everything on the line to get that done. And I am praying and believing that day is coming down the road for us. You know, it's different too. I mean, I have to remind my brothers and sisters, you know, we do not have a true pro-life president. We have someone who did wonderful things in the Supreme Court, but he actually looks at Iowa and thinks we probably went too far. And so I actually believe we ought to be having a life at conception bill federally. And it frustrates me some degree that some people believe that the Supreme Court ruling said it went back to the state. That's not what the Supreme Court ruling said. It said it doesn't belong in the hands of judges. It belongs in the hands of legislators, whether we're talking statewide or whether we're talking national. And the reality is we want to make sure that every life is valued, whether that's here in Iowa or it's in California or it's in Florida or it's in Oregon. Every life matters. And then we're paying a price for our society for it. We're paying a price because we don't value life. And so I just keep looking for the path forward. I won't be in the legislature next year because I'm retiring, but I pastor a church. I'm very actively involved on this issue, and I'm going to keep pushing and pushing hard. It's been a challenge, you know. I don't even know where you categorize yourself, but it was a challenge this year getting hit on the right and the left. You know, I would say to some degree, I can take the left all day long. But it has been extremely disappointing to see pastors and churches, attacking because we have some disagreement on one aspect, and that is whether or not we automatically in every case ought to be prosecuting a woman for an abortion. You and I know there certainly are cases where we see women cavalierly or maliciously bragging about it. But I got to tell you, I'm a pastor. I've been around all kinds of women in different situations. I see 55% of women who are trafficked end up having an abortion. We know that women who go in for abortion are heavily in abusive relationships. And so there is a coercive force. And some women, they always bear the guilt of what they have done to some degree. But there are women out there who are in relationships where there's a responsibility that goes upon the man. So, you know, that's where it's been tougher in the recent years, is because there's division in the pro-life community. The biggest challenge for me is not that we don't that we disagree in that issue. We're right. It's okay for us to have those debates and those dialogues. What bothers me, and I'm telling you, I'm speaking now as a pastor, and I'm going to speak loudly on it, is the fact that there's been accusations of fundraising on the issue. There's been the whole purpose to basically disenfranchise those who don't share a viewpoint on charging a mother with first-degree murder. And to me, that's become divisive. I think it should be a topic of discussion. I think it has worthy to have a seat at the table and have discussion about it, and us to work our way through that discussion. But to make that to say you're in or you're out based upon that issue seems to me to not only misunderstand scripture, but it seems to me to also misunderstand God's call for us to work together on this very important issue.
Yes, yes. And you know, honestly, my representative is Samantha Fett. And I feel like I would closely align with her on this. She was one of the ones that also sponsored House File 2316, which did include the prosecution of the mother as well as hindering IVF. But then she's also on part of the sponsor for House File 2332. And I think that kind of how I look at it is that we can come to the conclusion of what the punishment should be after we make it illegal. And I know that I'm going to get some hate, probably on both sides for saying that. But I think that, you know, it's kind of like I'm a dad, I got five children, and disobedience is always wrong. However, the punishment is not necessarily always the same. And so,
we see that in the scriptures, right?
Yep. Yep.
I mean, God always looks at intention of the heart.
Yeah. So it's one of those scenarios of like, if my kid legitimately forgot something, I'll probably be more compassionate than if it was a blatant rebellious disobedience.
And that's why, just so you know, Max, that's why the bill that I sponsored on the floor for life at conception went after the doctor. It reclassified and put new definitions to femicide so that we were basically saying there is a chance that a doctor who went through that process could be charged with first degree murder. And we wanted to make sure that's there. But there's also, like I said, even when I watch an engagement, so I attended the abolitionist, the first weekend they had here in Des Moines. I spent all Friday night and all day Saturday because I wanted to hear, I wanted to understand, I wanted to see what their biblical perspective was. And I appreciated their perspective, and I don't agree with their interpretation of how they use some scriptures in terms of defending that, you know, automatically because murder requires death, that this is what it means when a woman commits adultery. I don't think they build that case as strongly as they think they do. And again, it's open for discussion and dialogue, but we need to make sure we're having that discussion dialogue and not moving people out. It's interesting for me, just Max. So I don't believe in any exceptions. Okay. So that's my personal belief.
Yep. I agree with that.
And I want life at conception, whether the baby is alive because of some horrendous act or whatever it may be. The only exception I think that exists out there is normal medicine, which is just when it's life and life. You know, I'm talking about mother, daughter, mother, son, that type of thing. But I also know that I can't always get every person to agree with me. And even though I will continue to push that way, I'm going to go through the process of making sure that if I can get a bill, I mean, I'd love to say across the aisle, when they look at me and say, well, you're not allowing for an exception for rape, my answer back to them, so make sure I understand you. If that was the exception and that was the only, and that was part of the bill, you would vote for a life at conception bill. Yeah. And the answer is no, they wouldn't. They wouldn't.
Yeah, right.
We got to call that bluff, because I'm saying I'm willing to compromise and I realize it's the loss of life, but the reality is that's not their compromise. And I have questions about IVF. I don't know necessarily if IVF, I don't believe, needs to be outlawed, but this idea of producing massive amount of embryos that are unnecessary and then testing them, to me, we have to recognize what that is. That is the taking of life. My wife and I actually had difficulty having children, so we went through multiple failed adoptions from China, Vietnam, in the States here in Iowa. But one of our last things that we adopted was someone else's embryos. And so my wife carried six embryos that belonged to another family that actually, you know, had those embryos or those fertilized eggs, and they became a life. And so we've gone through that process. And so we understand that and we believe in the value of it, but it is crazy science. And we're going to have to, at some point as a legislature, not necessarily outlaw it, but we're going to have to put some parameters about that. You shouldn't be able to reproduce these lives and put them in a freezer. There's a million frozen, what they call embryos, across the nation that people are paying a service fee on. They've seen life come from them and they don't quite know what to do with the leftovers. And so these lives, and so they end up getting destroyed. So I'm very excited about restorative reproductive medicine that I see out there. There are things that I'm working on behind the scenes to build that area up in Iowa and across the nation, because as we pull that back and put some limitations on IVF, I believe you need to have this restorative reproductive medicine, which I believe is healthier for moms and dads. I also believe it's healthier for babies. I believe it's lower cost. And some of the statistics I'm reading means also it's actually, in one sense, has greater results than IVF. So.
Yeah. I definitely think conversations need to shift from whenever we talk about infertility, just to go straight to IVF as the solution versus, the age of the woman that's having the baby. I think there's a lot of people that prioritize careers until they get into their, 30s, and it's more difficult to have babies as we age.
And what
And then
IVF
also
doesn't
diet
address,
and
yeah, go
weight and
ahead.
all that stuff. There's a lot of those types of things, and it's like, if we got some of those under control, maybe fertility would come more naturally. And I know that that's not the rule, that would be the exception. But I think we should be talking, like you say, about reproductive, more natural fertility treatments and such.
That's what restorative reproductive medicine does. It goes after and says, let's address the cause of infertility. IVF does not address the cause. And so there are wonderful fields of study in this area that can identify the cause and treat it. And now we can have a child without going through IVF. And so I agree 100% on that. And the key is, I just so you know, we've got to create fields of medicine. And so, I dream someday of having a restorative reproductive medicine at one of our universities, where we're producing doctors and who are in that space. Because being someone who went childless for 11 years, we did end up having two boys. But the reality is, and as a pastor, I see also families that struggle with not being able to have a child. And restorative reproductive medicine can be a wonderful, wonderful process. But there's just not a lot of practitioners, true practitioners, in the area. And IVF's a big business. I
It
mean,
is a
it's not
huge
a cheap
business.
process in terms of that. So.
So I want to jump back, because that whole life of conception thing, where I think where we might have our difference on this is, I think there's sometimes that kind of like the Spartans, or the soldiers of the Alamo, that fought a losing fight for one purpose, and that was to stall for time, to allow other people to come in and save, the Republic and all that stuff. How can we vote now in the primary to get the people out? You say we're in the high 40s. I'm assuming that means that there's high 40s that would vote for that life of conception bill, which, if that's my understanding, then we're sitting at close to 20 people that claim that they're pro-life, that now are able to go back to their constituents and get reelected in this primary season and in the general election. And so, how can we, if that bill doesn't go forward through subcommittee, through committee, and force that vote so that we can actually see that, hey, these are the people's, how they would actually vote, how can we go vote them out of office?
Well, Max, you got to ask the question of the candidate. And you have to be specific to understand, because there's nothing that a candidate can hide if they say, I believe at life at conception and I'll vote for a life at conception bill if it brought across my desk. You can ask them specifically, do you believe in exceptions? You can get that clarity from them. You can ask those questions. But yeah, I think you have to also realize, and this is, and I hate to say this, and it's just the reality. One of the things you discover very quickly at the legislature, and I actually believe it's the genius of the legislature. It's, by the way, it's one of the things that you find in the body of Christ as well. But we do have the Spirit of God that kind of leads us in our discussion, is we live in community. There are no lone rangers up at the Capitol. Every bill to become law takes 51 votes in the House, 26 in the Senate, and a governor. And so you're always building together a sense of community. And so, not all Republicans who are elected see things exactly alike. You could talk to even the difference between a wonderful legislator like Skylar Wheeler and myself. There are differences in our districts. I would say I'm as conservative as he is. I came from a district that was blue that became red. He's in a district that he'll never, at this point in the foreseeable future, ever have a challenge. And so, there are sacrifices that you make to have 67 seats. There are ones that vote with you on 90% of the issues, but not 100%. It's usually never 90%. It's actually higher than that for most. So the reality, I think you have to ask the question. And I think you have to know who you're voting for and what they're bringing to the table. But I don't believe in Jack Bauer legislators. A Jack Bauer legislator, remember the Series 24? He was this counterterrorism unit guy, and he knew better than the president. He knew better than everybody else was corrupt but him. And he was his own righteousness in his own mind. And I have to tell you, when you're a pastor and you live in a church setting and you work with a congregation, I believe in the power of the body. And so you're listening to those around you. And so it's frustrating sometimes because it'd be nice as a pastor to say, "Thus saith, I'm going that direction, and you need to follow me." That's not how it works. And that's not how God wanted it to work. In the legislature, it's the same thing. What I appreciate, I mean, I'm going to tell you, that black market abortion pill bill would not be alive without Pat Grassley. If everybody knew what Pat Grassley and what the majority leader did behind the closed doors, we had to move it to appropriations because we didn't have buy-in at the Senate at that time. But to keep that alive, I mean, he purposely, and he was willing to put that on, even though he knew it was going to be controversial, because he believed in it. And he would, I mean, I appreciate that, even though Pat and I don't see eye to eye in everything. I do believe on that issue, he made a very courageous decision. So ask your legislator, build the support around them that says we as churches want you to be an advocate for life up at that Capitol. And not just with threats, but I'm talking about just the encouragement and the support. Because we who would have thought what the Supreme Court did? We should be having that here in Iowa. We should be having life at conception here in Iowa. And the black market abortion pill we passed will apply for life at conception. Because right now there's women who are getting black market abortion pills in, and they're having it after there's a heartbeat. And we didn't purposely put in any age so that when we get a life at conception, this bill stops it. Because what we're dealing with is these states, there's anywhere from 8 to 18 states who have shield laws that won't allow us to prosecute. And so, we're trying to find our ways to stop this. Now, at some point, I hope the Supreme Court's going to rule on that and deal with that, but they haven't yet. But we put together a bill that we knew when we passed the life at conception bill, this chemical abortion pill bill still applies. It just applies now, getting rid of all of them forever and ever, all men. I mean, think about this, Max. This is the other part that bothers me. When people say, "Well, it's not going to discourage abortions at all." Well, 60% of all abortions, I believe, are happening through a chemical type abortion right now. Max, we know
That's
for a
crazy.
fact. We know for a fact, though, that when someone has to sit down and have a discussion with a doctor, they get discouraged from having an abortion just because they have to think about it. And so there's a we created a process where you can't take a pill without standing before a doctor and hearing about what happens with this pill and being understand of informed consent on this bill. Yes, we changed it for two reasons. The two big major changes was removing from the bill the reversal pill, and just because we don't have the science yet that I believe in the reversal pill. Everything I read says good, but we don't have the medical studies that would have protected doctors from being charged with malpractice if something happened in the midst of that. And so it was a concession, and it was something we made. But the other one was this reporting thing. We really wanted that, but here's what we found out, Max. We're again, remember, we're meeting with medical associations. Here's what we read between the lines. They were going to start reclassifying these problems in the emergency room. And so
Really?
you'd have a woman that's excessively bleeding, and it would be called excessively bleeding, but they wouldn't necessarily, we knew that was going to happen. And so we didn't want to put ammunition in their hands that said, "Hey, we've been reporting and we've got zero complications," when we know across the nation, it's 1 in 9, and some would say 1 in 7 have complications in terms of it. So, I mean, that's part of behind the scenes stuff you work on.
And we saw that with COVID, where somebody would die in a car accident and they died of COVID. And it's so like I definitely understand that piece of it, with regards to the medical field. I definitely think the medical field is full of people that are not, that wouldn't share our pro-life values. And I definitely think that there would be that incentive from insurance companies, from the medical field, whatnot, to reclassify, you know, as you're saying there. But
And Matt, just to put it in perspective, one last thing I'll add to it. I mean, two legislators that really worked hard on this were Devin Wood. It was amazing the amount of time she put into this. And then because there was science and medicine involved, she brought in Brett Barker as well, Representative Barker. And he was an unbelievable help in this area. And then we brought in some doctors. As we were listening to the medical establishment pushback, we brought in some doctors from Susan B. Anthony, SBA, who came in and helped us guide through the language so we could differentiate between what are they really asking for here? Yeah. And is this legitimate or is this something else we're missing? And so there was a whole lot that I can't tell you how much Devin and Brett Barker did in terms of shepherding this through. And they really got it all ready for the Senate. So everything we did in the House, they were at the same time negotiating with the Senate to make sure that we had a clear pathway in the Senate for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And Representative Wood, she worked that bill to replace the pregnant people with pregnant women. And I went to that subcommittee and had a great conversation with her.
I have a funny story about it, and she won't mind me. I'm actually doing her wedding on Saturday.
Oh, really?
yeah. I'm going to Missouri. She's getting married. But I remember early on, we first were not going to get the bill through before the funnel. We had to move it to appropriations. We were back in the speaker's office, and the majority leader was there, and their staff was there, and Representative Wood comes in and closes the door.
And that's always a good sign.
her passion about the bill and getting it through was incredible. I said, "Whoa, I am not going to get on the back on the wrong side of Representative Wood, because I mean, she was going to make sure that got through, and she was not taking no for an answer." So it was incredible.
Yeah, great. That's great. So I want to. I'm going to push back a little bit on, on the one piece that you said regarding asking the representatives. So I was actually at Warren County, Republican. That's where I'm at, down in Indianola. And we've got three Senate candidates. And I asked them flat out at like a cookies and coffee type of get together of their stance on abortion and pro-life stuff. And I was a little bit surprised that one of them said that she believes in all the exceptions. One of the gentlemen that's running, or the only gentleman that's running, former House Representatives guy,
John Thorpe.
He said that he said that he believed in you know, the life of the mother, and then he would have to evaluate against the rape piece.
And my camera just
I just saw that.
Yeah. There we go.
But see, now you have the
answer. I got a new camera.
Yeah, okay. No problem.
My camera. I got a new camera for this podcast thing, and it's not been exactly the most efficient thing. So we might have to change things around. But he had mentioned that he was for the life at conception. The only exception would be the life of the mother, and then he would have to evaluate the rape. And then Mandy Shivers, candidate, said she's not for any of the exceptions. So my thought is this, is that there's a lot of, and I'm not saying Mandy Shivers is this way, I think she's great, but there's a lot of people, as we've seen on the national side, that will say one thing and go do a completely opposite thing up at the legislature. And because they're an incumbent, they win. They're at a higher odds to win. So one of the ways that we could really know what that vote is if we forced it. So we saw this when Governor Reynolds introduced that ESA piece, and not to throw John Thorpe under the bus, but you know, the reality is that it came to a vote. He voted in opposition for it. Governor Reynolds endorsed his primary opponent and he lost the next election.
Correct.
But it was only after a vote was forced and they didn't get anything across the finish line that year because it failed. And then the next year, opponent gets put in, gets elected, and everything works. So I guess if we can do that with ESAs, why can't we do that with life at conception?
Yeah, and I'm not saying we can't. I mean, those are strategic decisions, but you need to know what you're doing. In other words, you need to know the end game. You need to know how much you're going to go to follow it up with. Just having a vote. Some of my concern of just forcing a vote and knowing that you're going to fall short, I'm not worried about somebody sitting in a red district who has a problem with voting for life at conception. Yep. May they lose their seat. I just know I've got some very strong conservatives sitting in highly competitive districts who are, I don't care what you sold them. If you told, if someone came to them and said, you should not vote for that bill, they would vote for it because they believe in the concept and they would pay an extraordinary price mm-hmm. in terms of that. So there is a moment, there is going to come a time. And I've told the Pro-Life Coalition, even on this bill, we had massive meetings everybody trying to understand what's going on and said, hey, if you want to unleash this tirade of folks against the legislature, let's just know the end game. Let's know what happens when it fails, that we're able to pick it up and we're ready and prepared to replace people or whatever it may be. So the key is you got to know when you're going to play that card. And by the way, that also means your leadership got to be willing to play that card. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yep. I knew from talking to the governor and her staff I think it's being signed next week now, but I knew they were going to sign. Those are all things you do as a legislator. You know where people stand on this issue. So I agree with you, Max. There's going to come a day where that is the right play. But we have to also then figure out what comes after that vote. How do we get to that place of saying, okay, what are we going to do to make sure we don't get put in this place again? Because just losing seats for losing the sake of losing seats without knowing how we're going to get the right people elected. We had a strategy, and we mm-hmm. saw what ESAs ended up coming in, and we ended up winning pretty strongly with that.
Yep.
And we continue to get further entrenched. So there is going to be a play someday. So I agree with you. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I still didn't think it was this year yet. Part of that's because it's one of those things when ESAs did that, we kind of cleared the deck. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. This was the issue. And we have a little bit of that with, I'll get irritated with a carbon capture pipeline thing. Yeah. I voted both ways on it only because my problem is, first off, my county wants it. That's part of the problem here. I voted against it, and then my farmers came to me and said, we want it. Oh, well, yeah. Okay, whatever. And I knew it was going to wouldn't change the vote. But the reality is we pushed that, and we made that an important issue. Abortion needs to be there too. Does that make sense? Yeah. It needs to become a defining characteristic of what it means to be a characteristic. I'm on the carbon capture pipeline. I'm not against the bills. I just think there can be better bills. I keep getting frustrated. Like, if we're going to deal with this, how don't we just deal with the whole, utility board and let's figure out
I agree about with that.
A 25, 30 year process that we can live with. Not just pick on one entity. Let's get it figured out the way we want it to be. But but those are things you have to be willing to take a stand on, and that means leadership has to be. The governor has to be. There has to be leadership on that issue. I think we're going to get closer to it.
Yeah,
but I think can I say one last thing?
Go ahead.
The other part too is, and I'll go back to, we need not that threatening gun at your head, but almost like that. That's got to be something coming. And I'm speaking as a pastor from the churches as well, that we're out there passionate about this issue and saying, get this done. You got our support. We're here behind you. We're going to take the shots with you. And there is nothing more important than how we value life. Go ahead.
Yep. Yeah. So here's kind of my struggle with this whole thing and why where we'd probably have our difference of the timing of it is, I think, and maybe I'm wrong on this, I hope to God I'm wrong. I think I do not want to call him governor. I think Rob Sand has a real chance at this governor's seat.
He may.
I think that him going around quoting a bunch of Bible verses, as much
hunting,
as he might
driving
be,
a pickup truck.
Yeah, I got it. Yeah. As much as he might be taking those verses out of context, and he is, and that's a different conversation for a different time. I think he's swinging a lot of that moderate Christian vote. Sure. that might be, not trying to profile anybody, but the elderly vote that, you know, they're a little bit more moderate. They're not really in that whole Overton window thing of where people are at. I think he might win. I hope he doesn't win, but if he does win, that's at least 4 years of for sure not getting a life at conception bill. And we aren't guaranteed tomorrow, you know, the tomorrow, the legislative tomorrow, as I put it, we're not guaranteed that after that. So if say 4 years from now he loses, we might not have the House or Senate or the ability to pass it. So I look at it, and where I'll be honest, I grieve about this, is I think that the life of conception is such a big topic that it's worth burning the ships over, so to speak. It's worth saying, hey, I'm going to risk my career. I'm going to do everything I can to get this across the finish line. And if I can't get it across the finish line, maybe my piece of this pie is to shift the Overton window to a little bit further towards acceptability of life at conception. And so I guess that's where I'm having a hard time with it, is,
well,
we could lose it.
Yeah. And
so if not now, when?
Yeah. Well, life changes fast. God's at work far greater than we are. And he's accomplishing his plans and his purposes. And, you know, I think people were shocked to see the Supreme Court do what they do. I mean, one of the problems with the pro-life movement is they've been, dog's been chasing the pickup truck and it finally caught it and doesn't know what to do with it. I mean, literally,
I agree with that. Yeah.
The greatest victory that happened for us became one of the greatest stalls on the pro-life movement. Okay, now what are we going to do? It almost became a negative to be pro-life. At least some politicians felt that way.
Yeah.
So, no, I do think it is a judgment and a strategy decision. If I felt we had the votes and it would have been productive, it would have moved the ball down the road, it would have allowed us to, I mean, right now, there's the other part I have is with a potential of a Rob Sand governorship, I want to make sure we maintain strong control of the House and the Senate, because the reality is there's a whole lot more damage that can happen if we don't have a strong stance. So I agree with you. It's a judgment decision. But I hate to use the word, but God, if God had shown me everything he wanted to change in my life the day I came to know the Lord Jesus Christ, and I'm being a little bit facetious here, I probably would have said impossible. It ain't going to happen. Yeah. It's too much. It's too much work. Yeah. It's too much change. He has slowly but surely opened my eyes. I really believe, I guess I would say it this way, Max. Pro-life community needs to get out there. We need to change Iowa as well. We don't have to have the legislature can be ahead of the public. That's okay. We're called to be leaders and we need to make principled decisions. But I'm not impressed with what I see out there in evangelicalism that I'm part of when it comes to this issue of life. And I feel it's weaker today than it was 10 years ago.
I agree.
We are, the legislature is a reflection of the culture. I don't want it to be that way. I want us to be, you know, leaders. And I think we have. That's why I'm very careful when I use the phrase. The legislature has been more prophetic. It has gone farther and further than some of the churches want us to go. And they don't want to touch the issue. We need to raise it up. And it needs to be not just the public and the legislators waiting. It needs to happen together. So I don't know when that's going to be. Maybe that's next year. Maybe it's not. But there is coming a period of time where I think you do burn the boats. But burning the boats for the sake of burning the boats, I mean, you got to say, Lord, I know that's what you want us to do. We're going to go all in here. And we're going to do that. And we got to know what comes next. We got to say, okay, Lord, where are we going next?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like, and I talked to, I had a Maggie DeWitty on the podcast recently, and we discussed this, this piece of it, but it was, I actually go to church with Senator Mike Pike, and he risked his entire career, really before he even started, his first year in, last year, on the eminent domain piece. And he joined one of the, I think it was 11 people that said they're not going to vote on anything budget-wise until they vote on that eminent domain piece. And the force to vote. Sadly, the Republican leadership of the Senate punished them, for lack of a better term, by removing all of those people from any sort of strategic ability for them to be able to pull that stunt again. And I say that you know, when I say stunt, I'm meaning that with respect, because on this particular issue, I'd align with Mike Pike on it. But there was 11 that risked an entire career and then got punished for it on eminent domain. And I'm against the pipeline, you know, for the record and such, but like, that to me is not necessarily a biblical issue. I mean, I think you can deduce that God made man to exercise dominion over his creation and whatnot, and so people's land.
But it's not a direct line biblical issue, correct?
Right. You can take principles, but it's not like thou shalt not conduct eminent domain type of Bible verses. And they risked it all on that. And then now we have the life of conception piece, where we had the ability to get two of them done, and neither one of them got across the finish line. And I don't think, I mean, I would align myself. I don't have a problem with the prosecution of the mother. I think the prosecutorial discretion comes in where, you know, the legislature makes a law that, hey, speeding is wrong. Well, if I speed to the hospital because my child's choking, obviously there's multiple tiers of ability for the law enforcement officer, for the county attorney, for the judge, the jury, whoever, to come to the conclusion that, this extenuating circumstance happened. But
Max,
the legislator doesn't have to worry about that, right? You see what I'm saying?
But Max, I don't think any of us know the full impact of what those 11 did. Okay. They created tremendous dysfunction in the Senate that we had this year. Bills that we needed that were important to me as a follower of Christ and important to me as a legislator didn't happen because of what happened last year. And I get upset and angry that a stinking carbon capture bill that's only about money on both sides is standing in the way of protecting foster parents, standing in the way of protecting adoptive parents, standing in the way of protecting a child custody case when it comes to gender transitions and gender ideology. And that is sacrificed on the altar of that issue. And again, I'm not picking on the issue. I'm just saying is we don't know how that's going to play out. I mean, I don't know if Clemish will be the majority leader next year or not. I'm sure he's up for reelection in the process of the change of senators coming in. But we don't know the outcome of that yet. So we don't know if it was valuable or not valuable. And here's the part that breaks my heart. And I would be fine if no eminent domain law came into being on carbon capture pipelines. But here's the part that concerns me is crud. Guess what? Summit just announced today they're readjusting their line. Yeah. They're still moving ahead and they won. They won.
Yeah.
What we have is dysfunction. So again, I'm not saying it was a bad thing or a good thing. I'm just saying is there is consequences for those actions that cost other things, cost other problems, cost other bills.
But isn't it worth that so to speak dysfunction over something so fundamental as life? I guess that's where I'm coming from.
Well, yeah, but they did it over carbon capture, which wasn't about life. It was about land, important issue. Land rights.
Right.
It can be. But the question is, you know, there's balances in everything. I'm not at a point where I say pulling that trigger today would have gotten us farther down the road. I believe more lives were saved today because of the black market abortion pill bill than if we had pulled the grenade, had a vote on the floor, which never would have happened, by the way. I don't control that. We never would have had a vote on the floor. That's not a decision I get to make in terms of that. I got to kill a bill, but I didn't get a chance to say this is going on the floor no matter what.
You got to be the face of it.
Well, yes, and someone had to take a shot for it. And so I said, you know what? This is too important. And it's painful because, you know, people, I don't really care about the liberals going after me, but when my own people go after me and say, what, you need to repent before God, and I'm saying, but we're going to save more lives because we passed the black market abortion pill. What if William Wilberforce, who the abolitionists use as kind of where they got their name from, and he's their hero. What if in 1807, he said, forget it. I'm not going to stop the slave trade. Would he have ever gotten to 1833? Now, there is a period of coming of 1833, wherever the year was, where you got to pull the pin, and he did, and we got rid of it, and there was a lot of journey in between time. So to me, it's only a matter of when. It's not a matter of if. So that's where I agree with you.
Right.
There is coming a time.
And with excuse me. And with that point, abolition didn't happen overnight. I mean, the Emancipation Proclamation didn't free any slaves. It just freed
the abolitionists
ones that
act like it
led
happened
north
overnight.
Of the Emancipation Proclamation. Right. And that's where and I'll actually be having a conversation with one of them at a later time. That's where I differ from them, as I say, look, like, slavery didn't end until the 13th Amendment got passed. That was when slavery was eradicated. But there was there was slave states. There was, you know, the Republic didn't really want new states in the Union that would introduce slavery in those states. So Iowa joined. We weren't a slave state. You know, all of these things. But it didn't happen overnight. So I am perfectly at peace with saying that life at conception will not happen overnight. But at some point, I think we're not going to see eye to eye on it. And I think that we can kind of agree to disagree, because I see what you're saying, is that I think this was the moment to burn the ships and you don't. And I think that's where our primary difference is.
Yeah. And I had nothing to lose by burning the ships for me personally, other than, you know, people being mad at me. But so for me, it didn't come down to trying to preserve a position. I was trying to figure out what do we do as a leader to be able to get the most done this year in terms of it. So I where we agree is it's not a matter of when, it's a matter of if. And I'm going to double down. And I don't share some of the abolitionists' viewpoints and the manner in which they communicate themselves in this issue, but I do share their passion for life.
Yep.
And saying we've got to build some intensity around this issue and move forward on it. So,
yeah. And I want to, I know we're at time that we agreed upon. So I'll just ask one more question. And then let you go. I want to be respectful of that time. So you'd put out a Facebook post, that really got a lot of people going. I think that there was some misunderstandings. That's me trying to be gracious on it. But one of the comments that came out to me is that it seemed to pit the gospel against the abolitionist position, saying that the gospel is not the law is here, prepare for execution. It's, you know, Christ died for us, all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to get your thoughts and clarification on that, because where I have a hard time with it is the gospel of Jesus Christ grants forgiveness of sins, but it also doesn't eliminate human accountability either. So could you talk a little bit about that? Because that definitely sounded like it was if you're an abolitionist position and you believe in prosecution of the mother, that is an anti-gospel message.
No, and that's not my intent behind it. My intent in communicating that is the manner in which they communicate it, with that being the linchpin of what makes this biblical or unbiblical, is whether or not we're focused on putting a woman in prison. That is my intent behind that. God, the gospel includes the call to, I mean, the gospel includes justification and sanctification. It includes that we are, you know, declared holy, we are made holy, and then we are progressively made holy over time in terms of progressive. And so my only point is it just seems like where I can agree and say, I let you be part of the kingdom of God if you believe that a woman should go to jail. Okay, that's okay with me. I don't feel that from the abolitionists. After sitting through a Friday night and a Saturday night, they make it sound like you are not a biblical Christian if you do not have a passion in your heart, not for life, don't have a passion in your heart to put a woman in jail if she has an abortion, and making that kind of the determiner that you are somehow violating the word of God. I'm just saying is, let's bring the full testimony. And there are tensions. I mean, there's tensions in the story of the woman caught in adultery. You know, whether or not it was in the Bible or not, that's another whole story too. But but the woman caught in adultery, it's easy for us to point fingers, you know, but Christ knew her sin, knew the man's sin. He knew what was behind the coercion and why she was brought forward. And he didn't dismiss her sin by any means at all. He said, go and sin no more. But at the same time, there was an offering of grace in there. And I just don't want us to always lead with that. Almost, I mean, how I leave an abolitionist seminar, I left with a sense of they're just angry and mad. And I get that's part of understanding and, in Jeremiah, or I can't remember, it's Jeremiah or Lamentations. I mean, they're both books right now reading my devotions, but you know, they send out the prophet to mark people who grieve over sin. And so we are called to do that, but there is a difference between being grieving and being angry. And so I'm not trying to communicate that. I am trying to say, I really do struggle with that. There is some sort of, this is the line you can't, that determines whether or not you're part of the kingdom of God, is whether or not you believe that what they call equal justice, which I don't believe is used correctly in the scripture passage they use. Because we don't see equal justice in the way they use it in the scriptures. We see manslaughter. We see the intent yep. behind is there. And so, you know, and by the way, I remind myself all the time, we don't have a death penalty yeah. in Iowa. So we yep. can't even do a first degree murder the way some people believe that. So I don't want to yeah. communicate that, but I do believe there is a sense of restoration and healing, even in practical law. You know, Max, I just say this. I was doing some reflecting again, and I work for the Family Leader and the wonderful organization, and we use Romans 13. But Romans 13 also, people use it to talk about, well, you need to be the sword of God's righteousness. Well, there's yeah. definitely that truth in there, but that is not the point of Romans 13. Romans 13 is explaining even Nero and that yeah. evil, wicked, corrupt government. You have to understand the institution of government, even led by ungodly people, has a role. It's what helps establish righteousness in our society. Doesn't mean it gets it right all the time, but it is part of it. And so I think there's also a sense of here is, like I said, I'm not going to be someone who couldn't fellowship with someone who believed that a woman should be prosecuted. I'm not someone who would look at them and say, I'm not sure I could even be in the church with you. I feel from the abolitionists, that's how they feel about people like me who say, slow down. I get where you're coming from, but I'm concerned about some women's because of the way our culture is handling this. I do believe they are, some are coerced and are victims and find themselves in difficult situations. And we may not see eye to eye on that, but that was the point behind that. It really was a critique of their position. And their position says the gospel includes judgment of a woman. I'm saying the gospel includes some elements of grace and mercy and the opportunity for restoration.
Well, John, I really appreciate the conversation.
Well, good.
I appreciate you coming onto the podcast. You're always welcome onto the podcast anytime. And thank you. I know some of those questions got a little direct,
but that's
I hope
okay.
that, we have unity, because I think what you're saying, reflecting on the pro-life movement, I think we jumped up and down when Roe was overturned. And I think that we don't really know what our next objective is.
I agree.
And I think that hopefully this conversation helps point people, you know, whoever listens to this episode, points people into what is our objective? Let's actually
right.
have that conversation. Of course, I think it's life of conception.
Yep.
To include banning IVF is my personal view mm-hmm. on it. But I think that rather than saying, hey, this is what the movement should look like, I think that people need to say, what should the movement look like? And have those dinner table conversations of, you know, what do we do? How do we get involved with this? And I really do appreciate you coming onto the podcast.
Yeah, thank you, John. Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.